Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the entry of independent Senator Bernie Sanders into the 2016 presidential race and discuss his likely impact on the Hillary Clinton campaign with Democratic strategist Ed Kilgore, the principal writer for The Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He has a new book, Election 2014, Why Republicans Swept the Midterms, and we will analyze the turnout factor for Democrats and whether or not they have to be inspired to vote, as opposed to the Republicans who seem to be able to turn out every last one of their voters in midterms and presidential elections. Then, with six police officers on trial for the murder of Freddie Gray in Baltimore and the mayor lifting the curfew, we will look into the broader economic and social issues that have been addressed in the wake that have to be addressed in the wake of the recent riots. Bill Fletcher Jr., a longtime labor, social justice, and international activist, joins us to discuss his article at Telesur, Baltimore Race, Class, and Uprisings, and the extent to which, rather than have activists parachute into demonstrations every time a black man is shot by the police, sustained community organizing is needed over the long haul to bring about social justice. Then finally, we'll get an assessment on how dysfunctional the leadership is at the top in Saudi Arabia, with a king who might have dementia and his reliance on his youngest son, who may not even be 30 years old, who has not only been made defense minister, but is now in charge of the oil ministry and the world's largest company, Aramco. Youssef Ibrahim, who served for 18 years as a senior regional Middle East correspondent for The New York Times, joins us to discuss divisions and dissatisfactions within the ruling Saudi family that may surface soon. And joining us now is Ed Kilgore, who's a principal writer for The Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He's also the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and he's the author of Election 2014, Why Republicans Swept the Midterms. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ed Kilgore.
Thanks a lot, Ian.
And what's your sense then of the entrance of Senator Bernie Sanders into the presidential race? He's an independent, but he caucuses with the Democrats and might well run as a Democrat in order to get into the debates. He's just had a very successful and warm welcome up in New Hampshire, and some money's pouring in. Also on the Democratic left, there's a lot of wishful thinking about Elizabeth Warren running, and she has no interest in running, but nevertheless, people want her to run. So is this 2016 going to be a problem for Hillary Clinton, that the Democratic left is not going to show up?
I don't think so. I mean, you never know, and I'm sure that Team Hillary would prefer to have no primary opposition and to hoard its money, and also to let the early attention be on a large, fractious, and extremist Republican field. But, you know, if you got to have an opponent, this may be a best-case scenario for Hillary Clinton. I don't know how many more times Elizabeth Warren has to say no before those wanting her to run for president finally give up on her. Martin O'Malley, who probably did the best job of early organizing for a challenge to Clinton, may have really taken a body blow from the events in Baltimore recently. His record as mayor is sort of drawing some negative attention from precisely the kind of people you might expect to be sympathetic to his presidential run. And so far, Jim Webb is kind of all talk. So it looks like, and I sort of felt this way all along, Bernie Sanders may be the really only significant primary opponent for Hillary Clinton in 2016. And, you know, I think it's a challenge she can manage, and some would even say it might be good for her.
Well, you can't have a monologue. You've got to have a dialogue and a debate on the Democratic side, surely. I mean, there's, what, 20 Republicans? It's going to look pretty strange, Hillary up there debating herself.
Yeah. Well, some activity is usually better than no activity. It gives her an opportunity to clarify her point of view. And because Bernie is a self-identified Democratic socialist, there may even be a bit of triangulation. Hate to use that word, but I think it may help Hillary appear a little safer and more moderate to swing voters than, say, a Jim Webb or a Martin O'Malley or even Elizabeth Warren. So the key thing is, you know, Bernie Sanders has a reputation for being a very positive sort of campaigner. And that could be the really important thing. If he becomes a conduit for what it is in a, or he offers sort of a preview of Republican personal attacks on Hillary Clinton during the primaries, that could be a problem. But I sort of doubt that's going to happen. He has a pretty long record of campaigning on his own principles rather than attacking opponents.
Well, he, in his first 24 hours since he launched his candidacy, he raised $1.5 million grassroots money, 35,000 online donors, gave an average of $43.54. And on Saturday's campaign said that the two-day tally from the trip to New Hampshire topped $2.1 million. Of course, unfortunately, money is what it's all about, and there's going to be tons of it on the Republican side. Can you run a campaign, an anti-money campaign, when money seems to matter more and more in our politics?
Well, I mean, it is going to be a handicap for Sanders. He's already said he will not be, accepting the help of any kind of super PAC. I suspect he will turn down most PAC dollars, that sort of thing. I think he'll have enough money to have his voice known, and since he's the only non-Hillary candidate in the game, he'll get a great deal of free media attention. So I'm not sure how important that is. In the general election, it's really kind of become a truism in political science that presidential general elections, money is grossly overrated. As long as you're not completely outgunned by the other side, it doesn't matter a great deal. There's so much free media given to the two nominees that, money is almost cold to Newcastle. So, I think it will, Sanders, the emphasis he is placing on campaign finance reform will certainly encourage Hillary Clinton to make the same kind of promises, which she already has done, that she would support a constitutional amendment, which is what it's going to take to significantly change the current system.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Ed Kilgore, who's a principal writer for the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He's also the managing editor of the Democratic Strategists and Online Forum and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and he's the author of Election 2014, Why Republicans Swept the Midterms. And let's analyze that, because that's something that alarms a lot of Democrats, and that is the idea that in the last election, the Democrats didn't show up and the Republicans showed up. Every last one of them showed up and they won back the Senate, increased their leadership in the House. And the spectrum of a one-party rule in this country, if they already control the Supreme Court, the Senate, the House, and if they get the White House, and I'm not talking about Republicans, Eisenhower-type Republicans, but today's Republicans are pretty radical on the right. Is that what it will come down to? I mean, sometimes and all too often, it seems that the Democrats' best argument is that we're not as bad as the other guys.
Well, it's just for a thousand reasons, which we don't have time to go through right now. Republicans are in a better position. The big reality of American politics right now are two very evenly matched parties that, have a base in two different kinds of elections, Republicans in midterms, Democrats in presidential elections. The kind of people who tend to vote in presidential but not in non-presidential elections are disproportionately located in the Democratic Party now, whereas the older, whiter voters who have always voted by disproportionate percentages in midterms are now heavily concentrated in the Republican Party. So that's why you have this sort of oscillating character of the last few elections, with big Democratic victories in 2006, 2008, Republican victories in 2010, 2014, and a pretty good Democratic victory in 2012. So my expectation is that the pendulum will swing again in 2016 towards the Democrats. But they're not really, Democrats are not really, they are positioned possibly to take the Senate back, certainly to hang on to the White House. The House is pretty much out of, you know, out of range completely. So, yes, I think it's going to be very important that Democrats turn out their voters in part by warning that we are perilously close to a governing conservative majority right now.
Well, but in your new book, Ed Kilgore, Election 2014, Why Republicans Swept the Midterms, so you're saying that this is sort of almost predestined, that more Democrats show up in presidential years, and because I remember...
Well, not forever, but certainly the current configuration, what's known as the Obama coalition, based on very high percentages and very robust turnout among young and minority voters. These are the people that from time immemorial are much more likely to show up in presidential than non-presidential years. It's not something that just happened. What's new is the close association of these two coalitions with the two major parties. So there's no question that the landscape is going to look better for Democrats in any presidential year right now. You know, the two big questions for Democrats really are whether a candidate not named Barack Obama can get the same kind of high percentage, very high percentages, and very strong turnout among those categories known as the Obama coalition. And the second big question is whether there's some, among swing voters, there's some sort of natural tendency after a party has controlled the White House for two terms to vote for change, and to what extent that is true. That's why it looks like those two imponderables is why I would be hesitant to predict a Democratic victory. But clearly it should be a much better year for Democrats.
Well, so when President Obama says that the Democrats have a congenital problem not showing up in midterms, that is, it may be an accurate observation, but it's not a deal breaker. In other words, there's a fairly safe prediction that they're going to show up, and they don't require inspiration because of the traditional definition of why midterms, why the Democrats don't show up in midterms, is that they're not inspired, and that's always been their problem. How do you inspire the base? And that's what people are attributing to the challenge that faces Hillary Clinton.
The problem is it's just not true. I mean, the people we're talking about have, when they were Republicans, they didn't show up in midterms. When they were independents, they didn't show up in midterms. It's a demographic problem more than one of inspiration or ideology. Now, at the margins, everything matters. But as I always like to say, enthusiasm in politics is a great thing, but, you know, once you make that decision to vote, you don't get extra votes for being more excited than not. So the challenge for Democrats is to get people to the polls. It's immensely easier in a presidential year for them. And again, this problem I'm talking about of the two electorates is not fixed in stone. You know, as recently as 2006, Democrats had a very big midterm election, basically because they carried the senior vote, which is now heavily, heavily Republican. So things could change in the future. Republicans could eventually figure out that they're not going to win forever when they're actively alienating minority voters. And, you know, Democrats may eventually find a way to appeal to older voters or to what's known as the white working class. But there's nothing about the dynamics right now that suggests anything different for 2016, with one big exception. The X factor for Hillary Clinton is how many women are going to be, you know, regardless of their background, excited about breaking that glass ceiling.
Well, Ed Kilgore, I recently spoke with Barney Frank, and he made the observation that when Republicans get mad, they vote. And when Democrats get mad, they either demonstrate or sulk and stay home. Do you think that is a kind of comparison, that it's a valid one?
I'm sorry. I love Barney Frank, but I just don't think that's necessary. I mean, for some tiny percentages, that may be true. But again, there's not a great deal of evidence that the turnout patterns depend on one's level of excitement. You know, maybe in this race or that race, this or that locale, 1% of the voting population, that's what matters. But obviously, Democratic politicians are going to spend as much time as they possibly can talking about the importance of voting, and I think that's what Barney was doing.
Well, but maybe it's because I live on the west side of Los Angeles, and which is sort of ground zero for the liberal left of the Democratic Party. It's the sort of ATM for the left of the Democratic Party. And, you know, recently Norman Lear hosted Elizabeth Warren, and everybody was sort of, you know, hoping that she'd run. And again, it's completely chimeric. So at the end of the day, are we exaggerating the Democratic left? Is it really a force to be reckoned with? Is this something that Hillary Clinton's going to win over?
Well, again, she cannot afford to alienate too many voters. So, you know, she's going to address the squeaky wheel in the Democratic Party. But, you know, we heard the same thing in towards the end of 2010, early 2011, that there was going to be a left-wing challenge to Barack Obama. It obviously never transpired, you know, and I just don't, unless Hillary Clinton makes some huge mistake or there's some big revelation out there that we don't know about, it's going to be very difficult for Bernie Sanders or anybody else to deny her the Democratic presidential nomination. You remember in 2008, after, you know, one of the closest nominating contests any of us could remember, you know, in the Democratic Party, and there were all these predictions of Pumas, Hillary Clinton supporters that would never in a million years support Barack Obama. Democratic disunity was not a problem in that general election at all. I just don't see that becoming a big factor this year. Again, unless something happens that sort of disables Hillary Clinton's campaign. And again, that could happen to anybody. That could happen to Bernie Sanders. That could happen to Elizabeth Warren. Hillary Clinton remains the most thoroughly vetted person in American politics today. So there's no particular reason to assume that something terrible is going to come out about her, much as Republicans will try.
Well, they're trying next week, I think. The House is going to be revealing supposedly more smoking guns on Benghazi, which has been going on forever and hasn't yielded anything. But they got some hacked emails that they're going to reveal.
Well, we'll see. But I mean, you know, of course they're going to say that.
Right. But what about that?
I'll believe it when I see it.
But what about the Clinton Foundation thing? Do you think there's any that has legs? In other words, Bernie Sanders is going to be running against big money, and you know the Republicans and through this guy Schweitzer, one of their operatives, has written this book, are going to be saying, you know, she's a hypocrite. You know, they're rolling in dough, the Clintons.
Yeah. None of us have read the book yet. From everything we've heard, it's going to be, yet again, a set of allegations about the Clintons that you believe if you hate them, you don't believe if you don't hate them. So it will convince people that are pre-convinced that any time a dollar gets within distance of the Clintons, some quid pro quo has occurred, it won't convince anybody else. I do think it's going to be interesting to see how Bernie Sanders plays this. I mean, he will argue that the Clintons represent a wing of the Democratic Party that's been too cozy with Wall Street, too uncommitted to labor, too interested in trade deals, that sort of thing. He's going to make those arguments. He sort of has to. But how he handles the stuff that the right's going to be churning out, you know, creating sort of appearance of impropriety issues for Clinton, is going to be interesting. And I'm not sure if Bernie does go in that direction, if it's going to help him or hurt him. I think there'll be some backlash among Democrats, particularly Democratic women, if he is seen to be sort of in league with Republicans that are trying to tear her apart.
Well, Ed Kilger, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
No problem. Anytime.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Ed Kilgore, who's the principal writer for the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He's also the managing editor of the Democratic Strategist and online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and he's the author of the new book, Election 2014, Why Republicans Swept the Midterms. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the broader economic and social issues that have to be addressed in the wake of the recent riots in Baltimore. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bill Fletcher Jr., a longtime Labour, racial justice and international activist, and the host of The Global African on Telesur English. He's an editorial board member and columnist for blackcommentator.com, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, and the co-author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labour and a New Path Towards Social Justice. His latest article at Telesur is Baltimore, Race, Class and Uprisings. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Fletcher Jr.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on the program.
And the mayor of Baltimore, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, just announced the lifting of the five-day-long curfew. And there was a fairly celebratory demonstrations on Saturday led by the Black Lawyers for Justice, organized around the social media hashtag Black Lives Matter. So things seem to be turning around there. But your analysis is that the left, what I guess in a way they kind of parachute in on these uprisings. There's no sustainable programs on the streets. There's no follow-on. Is that your main concern, Bill?
Actually, I have several. So you definitely have groups that parachute in, like this Black Lawyers for Justice, that has no roots there. But part of what I was trying to get at was that that we have to get beyond, when we're looking at a situation like Baltimore, get beyond understanding the rage of the people. It's like, of course there's going to be rage. This murder was so completely blatant. But on top of that, we've got to understand what has been going on in Baltimore for 40 years. And that those are the factors that one needs to appreciate in order to understand how this crisis has unfolded. The deindustrialization of Baltimore, the white flight to the suburbs, the emergence of a Black political class within Baltimore that to a great extent is disconnected from the rank-and-file individuals, the grassroots people. All of these things weave together created the seeds for the kind of explosion that we saw. The other part of what I was trying to get at in the article was that I was reading a lot of tweets when the uprising started. And what I found striking was that the tweets, the character of the tweets, was mainly one of supporting the rage very uncritically. There were few tweets that actually supported the people that were in the streets, the community organizers, the community leaders, the clergy, etc., who were trying to redirect incredibly angry youth in and redirect their anger in a way to really link this with an ongoing movement. And I feel like that's a problem with our analysis, that it's really not enough for us to talk about, yes, it's right for people to rebel, the rage is important, yes, but there's people in the communities that don't want to see their communities burned down, but want to see that rage targeted at the real culprits. And that segment, whether it was the Nation of Islam or whether it was various Christian ministers or these gangs that signed a truce and were working in the communities, or any number of other groups that were not people that were Uncle Toms, they weren't selling people out, they wanted to make sure that there were no massacres. And I feel like we on the left have an obligation to look at that and to highlight that work.
Again, I'm speaking with Bill Fletcher Jr., a longtime Labour, racial justice and international activist and the host of The Global African on Telesur English. He's an editorial board member and columnist for blackcommentators.com, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, and a co-author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organised Labour and a New Path Towards Social Justice. His latest article at Telesur is Baltimore, Race, Class and Uprisings. So there's no question, of course, that the deindustrialization is a huge factor, because after all, during World War II, Baltimore was, Bethlehem Steel was a powerful and huge employer, shipbuilding, etc., good middle-class jobs, and then outsourcing and globalization, etc., has hollowed it out to the point where you really do have a divided city. You have wealthy white suburbs, and then you've got vast areas of the city that are boarded up and that are really, particularly the Sandtown, the home of Freddie Gray. There is, for example, 85 men for every 100 women in the in Sandtown. And this is to do, and Hillary Clinton did address this at a speech at Columbia University the other day about the absolute evisceration of the black male, black society in this country, particularly with the warehousing of so many millions of black men in prison and this vast prison industrial complex. And it always leads you to the obvious question, Bill, which is, why are we spending all this money on these private jails and not educating and giving opportunity to youth? It seems like a complete and abject admission of failure as a society.
Well, I think that to a great extent it is. I mean, when we look at the situation, one part of what we've discussed today is the issue of the deindustrialization. The other part is this horrendous so-called war against drugs, which has become a means to criminalize all sorts of activities and to essentially presume the guilt of entire communities. Now, What does this do? Well, this does a few things. One of the things that the war on drugs does is that it deals with and locks up a segment of the workforce that is no longer necessary to capitalism. You know, we're talking about all of these industries that Baltimore had. Bethlehem Steel, Sparrows Point, I believe, had 30,000 workers at one point. You had auto plants, you had other firms, very significant jobs. Now, many of these jobs were incredibly segregated, including Sparrows Point, so that it was initially hard for African Americans to get in, and then when they did get in, they were often trapped in the worst positions. That only starts to change in the 1970s, at the same time that global capitalism is itself starting to change. And so, you know, the changes that needed to have happened much sooner come in many ways quite late. So you have this economic issue. You have these workers that are no longer necessary, and they get locked up. And then when you add on to that the growth of private prisons, it becomes a matter of profit, that these private prisons have to have people in them. And so this is a horrendous situation. Now, part of what I think our response has to be is in looking at the Baltimore crisis, is to go beyond the issue of police lynchings. It doesn't mean forget police lynching. It means going beyond that. That we have to have a broader racial justice movement that really is looking at issues of class and gender, that really is looking at issues of economic development. There will be more such killings when people don't have jobs. There will be a continued criminalization of black workers when people don't have jobs. We have to have an economic development strategy for Baltimore that really turns the city around. And the problem is that in city after city, the economic development strategies that are being followed are ones that benefit a small number of people. They are, for example, the building up of harbors and these, like in Baltimore Harbor, you see the same thing in Philadelphia, New York, and Boston, and very nice touristy areas. You have those building up. You have the finance, insurance, real estate industry in many of these major cities. But for the bulk of the workers in those cities, there is less and less for them to sustain themselves economically, which ends up meaning people end up being forced out. They end up either being forced into horrendous conditions within the cities, as in the site of the uprising, where you had an unemployment rate of about 30%, and an average income of $17,000. So you have that, or people are forced out of cities, frequently into what are called dead cities. And that is not a future that we want for workers.
So, Bill Fletcher, Jr., in terms of the war on drugs, obviously, we've all seen The Wire, the famous TV series, and there's no question that a lot of these street gangs are, in effect, organized crime that distributes drugs. That's their main income. So the drugs are pervasive. But my sense is that unless we tackle the whole holistically, this idea of why people take drugs, it's never, the question's never asked. It's just a punitive response. And they say they want to go after the kingpins, but they end up getting the small fry. And my sense is that if you talk about legalizing drugs, that's a political non-starter, you know, as well as a semantic trap. Medicalizing it makes sense, because if you basically have an outpatient situation and try and get people off drugs that way and take the money out of it, that makes an awful lot of sense. But at the end of the day, if you could do wave a magic wand and medicalize, take the money out of drugs, medicalize the situation, you'd still be putting back kids on the same street corner who they may have gotten off the drugs. But if you put them back to where they started without a job, you haven't won a damn thing.
No, that's very true. Although the one point that I would want to make about the war on drugs is that it effectively makes it easier to have an authoritarian environment in our cities. Because what happens is that people get used to the idea of ever-present surveillance and police intervention. It becomes commonplace. And that is a threat to democracy. So I just wanted to throw that in there. But I think that your point is correct. It's not enough to remove the war against drugs. But that goes back to what I was saying earlier. There have to be comprehensive economic development plans. Now, here is where one of the areas of challenge. In many of our cities, private capital is no longer interested in investing. Or what you have is high levels of speculation, so that different areas that are run down, speculators start buying them up with the idea of gentrification. The implication, obviously, is that people that are living there get removed. So it doesn't resolve a problem. It just simply relocates the problem. That's why the kind of political leadership that we need at this moment, at the local, state, and national level, is one that really is advancing economic development strategies particularly for our cities, and ones that get away from the notion that economic development is the creation of more sports stadiums and tourist sites. We have to really rethink what it means to develop our economy, and that also is going to mean fine-tuning and revamping our public school system so that the public schools are, the class size is reduced, and that they're producing the workers for the 21st century.
Well, Bill Fletcher, Jr., I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate the conversation.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Bill Fletcher, Jr., who's a longtime labor, racial justice, and international activist, and the host of The Global African on Telesur English. He's an editorial board member and columnist for blackcommentators.com, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, and the co-author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Towards Social Justice. His latest article at Telesur is Baltimore, Race, Class, and Uprisings. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into divisions and dissatisfactions amongst the ruling Saudi royal family.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Yusuf Ibrahim, who is an independent columnist and political risk consultant. He served for 18 years as senior regional Middle East correspondent for the New York Times and 6 years as energy editor for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Yusuf Ibrahim.
Hi, Ian.
Good, thanks, Yusuf. What are we to make of the fact that the new king of Saudi Arabia, his son, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, has been not only made defense minister, but now he's been put in charge of a 10-member council that's now going to be in charge of the world's largest oil company, Aramco. They've apparently set up this new Supreme Economic Council, which will replace the Supreme Petroleum Council. And again, headed by Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who, what, he may not even be 30 years old. We don't even know how old he is, right?
Well, we don't, but most, I mean, the official Saudi media is trying to suggest now that he's around more than 30. Other people would say he's under 30, but basically he's a very young man to be placed in an incredibly important position, especially that his older brother, Prince Abdulaziz Ibn Salman, has in effect been deputy oil minister for more than 25 years. And you would have thought, that's the son of the king, the older son of the king. He's been in that job on behalf of the royal family as the royal family consigliatore, if you like, inside the oil ministry, and he was passed over.
So how many sons does he have? And obviously they ranged over several decades in age?
It's easy to look up, but I kind of looked it up, but I don't have the number in front of me. I think he has four or five sons, that's for sure, who are directly from one mother. He's the favorite wife, and these are the ones who are prominent right now.
So the assumption would be that Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman, the long-serving member, he's also been a member of Saudi Arabia's OPEC delegation and
Forever.
Deputy oil minister. he's got to be feeling pretty upset that his youngest brother, who's already got his hands full with the war that he started down in Yemen, is now in charge of Aramco. It's pretty surreal.
Yes, but the Saudi style is to never wash your laundry in public. So you will never hear any complaining. I know Abdelaziz pretty well. Have attended perhaps 80 OPEC meetings with him. He's a cool character. He does not complain. He arrived at that position essentially being the royal family surveyor across the oil ministry, and has been there through three different oil ministers. But just think, how does the oil minister himself feel? I mean, Ali Naimi has been there all his life since he was 13 years old. Rose through the industry, is a Shiite who worked in the oil fields. Aramco, the Americans, put him through engineering school. He became very proficient as an oil engineer, and then a very efficient oil minister. And he's got what essentially is a 30-year young man telling him what to do.
Well, haven't they always, though, had technocrats in charge of the oil ministry? And the royals have sort of been there in the background, but not hands-on.
That is true, and that's done on purpose, because the idea, and that's something Salman has just changed, actually, and that's a very important observation, the one you just made. The reason that the royal family person was always in the background is precisely so as not to subject a member of the royal family to the kind of, you know, at OPEC meetings, there are public fights, there are insults sometimes. The Iranians call the Saudis names, and they never want a member of the royal family to be called names. And the big change that's just happened now is the king has put his sons directly on the front line, not only in oil, but in defense and in other areas. So basically, that's a fundamental, almost dramatic change in style of governing by the new king.
So my understanding is that this new, the King Salman, the new king of Saudi Arabia's son, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who's also a deputy crown prince. That puts him second in line after Mohammed bin Nayef, who was just promoted as crown prince.
Correct.
He's apparently he's very close to the U.S. and educated over here and stuff, and people are quite happy with him. Just in terms of technocrats as opposed to royals, the new foreign minister, of course, is not a royal. The U.S. ambassador. So that's an interesting change. But there's a lot of disquiet about this young guy that we're talking about, who may not even be 30. In as much as he's apparently become the extension of the king, and there are rumors that the king may have Alzheimer's or some form of dementia, and he relies more and more on this son as essentially an extension of him, like mini-me, you know? Is that your understanding?
Well, the Saudi royal family is very opaque. You remember the days of the Soviet Union, how many criminologists we had trying to figure out, parse and split hair what's happening in the Kremlin? Well, the Kremlin looks transparent compared to the Saudi royal family, the old Kremlin of the Soviet Union. So it is, whether the king is ill or not, is almost immaterial, Ian, because when you think about it, all the kings of Saudi Arabia since the founding father of the kingdom, I mean King Abdulaziz, have all been in their 80s. So it's very normal you're bringing an 80-year-old man to start becoming a king. And, you know, it's not going to last too long. I mean, you know, how long can he be king? In many ways, Abdullah lasted very long. But remember, Abdullah took over from his brother Fahd, who had a stroke. So, in fact, he was crown prince and king in the same time because his brother had a stroke. You are talking about a family where the older generation is disappearing. So in many ways, what King Salman was trying to do is bring a very young generation to the forefront. But there is a limit to how young, because the kingdom also is coming upon huge problems. First, it has entered a very dangerous war in Yemen. And the Yemenis are those Houthis who are basically a Yemeni a collection of tribes, they're not easy guys. I mean, remember, the Egyptians sent an Egyptian army there and lost 40,000 men between 62 and 68. They were defeated. And the Saudis have entered this war, which is run by the king's new team, basically, including his son and his crown prince. That's a dangerous step because it's very easy to start a war. You never know how you're going to end it. We experienced this in Vietnam. And Saudi Arabia is not America. It does not have the resources that we have. Secondly, the price of oil has dropped by 50%. I mean, the Saudi budget is based on price of oil that should be around $107. Well, as of yesterday, the price of oil is $59. And so there is a huge gap to fill. Of course, they do have vast reserves, so they can take the pain for a year or two. But the Saudis are entering a new age, and they need a leadership that considers less adventure, more wisdom.
Well, but aren't the Saudis themselves responsible for the low price of oil, that they're flooding the market to drive, you know, to get rid of the competition, the frackers, the Canadian oil sands, and to, as collateral damage, to punish the Russians, etc.? That's the conventional wisdom.
It is also true. It's not only conventional wisdom, but the bigger truth, the more important truth, is where is all the new oil that's flooding the market coming from? And it's coming from a completely new source, which is an old source. Who would have thought 3 years ago that the United States of America is about to emerge as the world's largest oil producer? Who would have thought that? Nobody. Who would have thought that the United States, by using this crack technology, would in fact already be the world's biggest natural gas producer? We're bigger than the Russians. So the revolution has happened here, and it has produced a flood of oil, which the Saudis had no choice but to accept. And their strategy is, okay, if you guys want to continue to produce that much oil, we're going to show you who can take the pain. Well, it's a little bit where we are now, because American oil producers are entrepreneurs. I mean, the guy has got a field, the field has got oil, he's got the technology, he's going to produce the oil. That's all. He doesn't care how much he can sell it for, as long as he's producing it cheaper than what he's selling it. And these guys in Texas and Oklahoma and everywhere else, they can produce oil at $40 a barrel.
But not the Canadians, though.
Sorry?
But not the Canadians, not the tar sands.
The Canadians have improved a lot, because the Canadians, the oil sands, if you compare the price of dredging, cleaning, and purifying, and then pumping the Canadian oil sands today, it is 50% less than it was when the technology was first discovered. So you got that much more oil coming from Canada at lower prices. And I remember, Ian, once upon a time in the 70s, we had never heard of North Sea oil. which is shared between the UK and Norway, and then today North Sea oil is still pumping 5 million barrels of oil a day. I mean, because the price was right and companies went in there. So basically, the chemistry of the oil market has changed, not to the advantage of the Saudis. In many ways, the Saudis had no choice but to wage war. What else could they do?
So let's turn to the King Salman. And you know, as I say, there's speculation about his health, whether he has dementia or some form of Alzheimer's, and that perhaps explains why he's become dependent on his son, the younger son who's been elevated to both the defense minister and now to head up this new council that oversees the world's largest oil company, Aramco. The fact that he got rid of the only female lawmaker who had been trying to improve the education for women, apparently that's throwing a bone to the conservatives. Apparently they were angry with the previous King Abdullah for appointing women and for encouraging women. So where does that battle stand between the so-called modernists and the Mutawa, the religious establishment?
It stays within a certain parameter where one team takes it that far. Abdullah was seen as a quote-unquote progressive king. Everything is relative in the end of the day. In a country where women cannot drive, where they cannot leave the house without the permission of their husbands, where they cannot leave the country without the permission of a male relative, and where they cannot be in a car without a man that is their husband, and that was under King Abdullah, you're exaggerating things a little bit when you talk about liberal or modernizing. I mean, everything is relative, but it's still a completely oppressive country. Now, the fact that Salman has come in and brought and canceled everything, every little gimmick, every little really artificial improvement that King Abdullah had made, means they have regressed. But I mean, basically, they're advancing 1 kilometer and coming back 1 kilometer. This is not what we in by any measure of rational standards we can call progress. This is not modernization. Modernization is, you know, what you have in Iran, for example. Women drive in Iran. They have never been banned from driving in Iran. They wear makeup. They can go to parties. Same thing, actually, in neighboring countries, in the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait. And so in Saudi Arabia is like solidifying like a block of ice in a freezer, and a little bit of the ice became water under Abdullah, and now has gone back into the freezer. So I don't think that we should make a big deal of how conservative, but clearly Salman is playing to the conservative priests, the guys, those bearded guys who run the theology of Saudi Arabia.
Well, but let's focus on them. Are they as powerful as, I mean, this is the eternal excuse of the Saudi royal family. Oh, well, you know, we'd like to liberate our women and modernize our country, but, you know, we have this conservative backlash. Are they that powerful? I thought in many ways the Wahhabi establishment and the religious police were a kind of creature of the royal family, that they're there to essentially keep the population in line, because the ultimate form of oppression is a religious oppression. If you can't, if you're worried about whether you're showing a little bit of ankle or a wisp of hair under your burqa, I mean, you're not going to be plotting revolution.
You are right in so many ways, in the sense that this has been a 60-year partnership between the royal family and the Islamist preachers. And basically the deal is, I'm going to liberalize a little bit, But if things get out of control, I want you to come back in. I'm going to use you to be a brutal police. And it's like they're passing a soccer ball between each other. And what Salman is doing is he's just repassed the ball again to the religious establishment and asked it to stand by him as he consolidates power, because he is consolidating power in a new way. He's putting his relatives, his sons, and he's removing all of Abdullah's people, and he needs the total support of the religious establishment. So he's feeding them all the little progress that Abdullah had offered. He's taking it back. When he feels a little more secure, you'll hear some more talk about, maybe one day we'll let women drive. But we've been hearing this stuff for 25 years, right?
Well, but the difference is that in the last few years, there's been a thing called the Arab Spring. Now, a lot of people think that why did the Saudis encourage all of these jihadis to come in there and make a complete mess of the Syrian revolution? One of the theories is that they don't want any other form of political Islam to survive, except their sort of medieval monarchic model. And at the end of the day, how can you keep this kind of all of that money and power in the hands of this one family in the days of satellites, of Google Earth, where people can look inside the palace walls of these vast estates? 25% of the Saudi population is poor, and you've got this huge Shiite population that's very restive in the very area where all the oil comes from. So,
and also 40% of the Saudi population is very young, under 27.
Right.
So they got a lot of problems, and you do it. How do you keep it, you ask? You keep it. What does Saudi Arabia export? Saudi Arabia exports only two things: oil and the Wahhabi Islamist religion. It produces absolutely nothing else. They don't make cars, they don't make machinery, they don't make art, they don't make movies. In fact, movies are banned. There is nothing coming out of Saudi Arabia except these two things: oil, on which the economy depends to the tune of 99.0%, and subsidies given to the population to keep it quiet. But in return for this, I must say, and a lot of people who do go to Saudi Arabia know that, people who lived in Saudi Arabia, including all our United States ambassadors, for example, who lived in Saudi Arabia, who are Arabists and experts in Arab affairs. Fundamentally, you got to accept that the Saudi population itself is profoundly conservative. And you'll be surprised in Saudi Arabia how many women actually defend the oppression of women.
Well, Yusuf, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I wish I had more time, so let's talk again.
Okay.
Thanks
a
lot. You too. And again, I've been speaking with Yusuf Ibrahim, who is an independent columnist and political risk consultant. He served for 18 years as senior regional Middle East correspondent for The New York Times and 6 years as energy editor for The Wall Street Journal. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.